they said was much better than the book they spoke about. Honored and grateful for your kind and gracious words. My sincerest gratitude to all of you. A couple of years ago, I called my father on the telephone. At that time, he was about 87 years old. As a son who doesn't call him as often as I should, I asked him, "Father, how are you?" Now, every time I've ever asked him this question, no matter what, he always says, "Oh, I am fine." He never wants anyone to worry about him. Years before, I was in Delhi on my way to Bharsana, the home of Sri Radha in the Vrindavan area, where we were going to lead a pilgrimage of several thousand people for several weeks. So I just happened to call from Delhi, and I talked to my father, and I said, "How are you?" And he said, "I am fine." What he always says. And my mother gets on the phone, and she waits for my father to walk out, and she said, "Actually, he just had a heart attack, and tomorrow morning he's going in for a quadruple bypass open heart surgery. But don't tell him I told you this, because he'll be very angry at me. Because he doesn't want you to worry about him." So I never told.
Of course, over the years, you see this tape recording, you know. But I did pray for him in Bharsana to run around him. He was fine.
So that's the kind of person he is. So this day, I called him and I asked, "Father, how are you?" He burst it out. "Terrible." Never heard that from him before. I said, "What happened?" He said, "I didn't sleep all night." I said, "Is there a reason?" He said, "Yes. I read your book before I went to sleep." "It was worse." I said, "Which part did you read?" He said, "You were being sucked down by quicksand. And you were growing deeper and deeper, and you grabbed onto this bush, and the bush had thorns on it. You were pulling and pulling, and your hands were getting sliced by the thorns, and then the whole bush came out from its roots. Somehow or other, you escaped the quicksand, and then you started drowning in a river." He said, "All night, I was rolling around in my bed, thinking of my little Richie drowning in rivers and being sucked into quicksand. And every time I'd fall asleep, I would get this image of you in this quicksand." And he said, "All night I was thinking, you were all alone, there was no one around. If you would have died, your mother and myself would have spent the rest of our lives searching for you, and we would have never found you and never heard any news what happened to you." I said, "Father, that was 38 years ago. Now I'm fine. I'm not in quicksand. I'm not in rivers. I'm back at the top. not understand the heart of a father or a mother. Just the thought of a child in that predicament. How could we live?
Anyways, my father, he's actually, for his friends, he's given up to about over 200 terminals. He's 89 years old. It's an experience that I learned. We can learn from every situation. Swami's cathartic. Swami's got no children. But we have much to learn from fathers and mothers. And hopefully, mothers and fathers have something to learn from Swami's too. Life is learning, sharing the grace that God has given us and receiving the grace that God has given others. Last year, I was invited to speak at the British Parliament. It was a cold, rainy day in London, and I was being escorted through these hallways of the British Parliament, very high ceilings, chandeliers hanging. The chandeliers were casting light on all these statues of heroes and warriors and kings. And as we were walking, our footsteps were echoing in the cavernous stone walls. I was led into one chamber, beautiful place. There was these textured cloth wall coverings, and below it was beautiful hand-carved wood. There were chandeliers, very old masterpiece paintings on the walls. And sitting before me was about 150 people. There were members of parliament. There was British lords and ladies. There was several archbishops, priests, rabbis, councilmen, mayors, lawyers, professors. And I was remembering how different this is than that cave that I used to call my home in the Himalayas. As I looked out at them, my heart was kind of racing. Not because I was supposed to give a lecture to them so much, but the paradox of life. That I don't have much education materially. I know practically nothing about British politics, British mannerisms. And I was asked to address this assembly in the House of Commons. The subject I was given was spirituality in the big society. The Prime Minister then was really pushing this concept of the big society. And I didn't even know what it was. So when I stood up, after being introduced and looked out at them, I felt really unqualified. And that's usually the best time to pray. So I said a prayer. Please, Krishna, please, Gurudev, help me to reach these people.
your message. And what should I say? And then I looked to my right side. There was a large window. So many large windows, these Gothic windows, and like domes on the top, beveled glass. And I just happened to look out the window. And it moved my heart so deeply what I saw. The River Thames. As she is flowing alongside Westminster for centuries and centuries and centuries. I looked across the river and I saw a stone boundary wall. And on that boundary wall was the very spot where when I was 19 years old, I would sit for hours and hours every night. In 1970, at that time, it was London that I questioned my existence more than any other time or place in my life. What am I doing? Where am I going? What's happening all around me? Do I want to be a part of it? When I was growing up in America, I was quite popular in my social circles, but very shy. I never had a girlfriend because I used to hear these songs about breaking people's hearts and what it felt like, and I didn't want to do that to anybody. Every friend of mine, every one of my friends either had a broken heart or broke somebody else's heart. That's American culture, to a large extent. But here I was in London, my friend Gary, and there was nothing to monitor or restrict anything I wanted to do. There, I was like a wild, hungry dog that escaped from its leash. And I was experimenting with things to really try to understand and experience what this world really is about. I was making the scene more successfully than ever before. Looking out at that boundary wall. Behind the boundary wall, and I could see it in my mind's eye, was that church where a priest back in 1970, he allowed travelers who had no money to sleep on the floor of his church for free. And I was perfectly qualified for that floor space. So Gary, after we would be in wherever the crowds of the young counterculture generation were in London, we were, you know, trying to enjoy like never before, all day, till late at night. And Gary would go to sleep in the church, and I would sit on that boundary wall. And I was thinking, I have more of the things I've always wanted materially than ever. But I was feeling totally empty. There was a battle going on in my heart. It was like my mind, my senses, my ego was dragging me to enjoy in this world, and there was this very silent calling in my heart, calling me away from it. And I was fighting, and I was fighting. And while I sat on that wall, current of the river and see the reflection of the lit-up clock tower of Big Ben reflecting off the surface of the river. And for hours, I would contemplate, I would pray, I would cry, cry for directions, cry for answers. And I wondered, where will the river of destiny lead me? And am I just wasting my time? Here I was, standing in the parliament, ready. Everybody's sitting, waiting for me to speak, and I'm looking out the window. And then I thought, 40 years before, 41 years actually, while I was on that wall, probably hundreds and hundreds of times, I was looking at the same window from the other side with no clue where the river of destiny would take. Today, Hari Bansa, who's the chief editor of a very, very wide circulating newspaper, who spoke today, he interviewed me and asked a question. He said, do you believe that all that you went through and to where you are today, was it all destiny? And I shared my experience that I learned from my beloved guru, from the holy scriptures, and from so many saints and sages in my life. That destiny can take us so far. Generally, destiny is a thing of karma. As you sow, so shall you reap. For every action, there's an equal corresponding reaction. If we do good, we get good. If we do harm, we get harm. It's just a matter of time. But there's something beyond destiny, and that is kripa. Grace. Grace intervenes within destiny and lifts us beyond destiny and actually connects us with Bhagavan, with God, with Krishna. And that mystic, magical grace. It's not something that looks for someone who's qualified or disqualified. It descends. We simply have to open our heart to receive it. And if we just make some right choices in life, that grace can heal us, protect us, inspire us, and empower us. And in my journey, I've found that there is nothing so precious in all of creation than that grace. And our chanting of God's names, our prayers, our meditation is to reconnect us with that grace, which is everywhere and within everyone. We just need to tune into it. For those of you who read the book, I'll tell a few things that happened years later. I don't know if it's only me, but I think it's a it's very difficult to open your minds to your parents. Have any of you ever had that experience? Even though they're totally open to hear and they're totally understanding, still, there's some, especially in America, there's something like that. So my mother and father and my brothers, when I came back from India, actually, when I was in, my visa ran out and I had to go to Nepal. And my parents were yearning for me to return home. Years went by. I was supposed to come home in 2 years, I mean 2 months. And it was a couple of years. So finally, I wrote them and said, you know, I will come to visit you. Because I couldn't stay in India. I was in Nepal. I said, either I'll hitchhike back, because I had no money. It'll take me about 6 months. Or you can send me a plane ticket. So I got a 2-week transit visa back through India. And I hitchhiked to Prayag, and I took third class trains to Prayag, and then Ayodhya, and then Vrindavan. But I finally reached New York. I had just enough money to get a ticket to where my parents were. They were in Miami, Florida. And somebody came up to me, a monk, and said, I'm stranded, living, I've been sleeping in the airport for so many days, and I want to go see my guru. He's in Los Angeles. I need $60. I happen to have exactly $60. So I was thinking, this is destiny. So I gave him all my money. So my father's at the airport after all these years, and I wasn't on the flight. And so then he comes home, and I call him Colette. I don't know if you know what that means. I gave all my... He said, where are you, son? I said, I'm in New York. He said, well, where were you? I said, well, I gave all my money away. So he happened to know somebody from an airline, and they got me on another flight. And he took me home. That was quite a culture shock for me, and quite a culture shock for him. But because of the affection we had for each other, it was kind of a gradual process. At first, I started preaching to them about what is Sanatana Dharma, and what is bhakti, and what is surrender, and what is devotion, and what is the goal of life, and how all your furniture, and your cars, and your prestige is all Maya. I said, what is Maya? I said, illusion, illusion. They didn't know what I was talking about. But little by little, I understood if I just accept them and love them for who they are, then I'm actually being real. And when I started doing that, they just began to accept me and love me for who I am, even though they couldn't figure out what I was or what I was doing. They loved me and they accepted me, and we became closer than ever. One day, Namamrita Devi's father-in-law came to Chicago. And he went to see my father. And my father asked about him. He said, what religion are you? He said, Hindu. Can you tell me? He said, for generation after generation after generation, my family have been devotees of Krishna. And then he told him he's a PhD from an American university, University of Pennsylvania. And he's owner of big international corporations. Goodyear tires, and my father used to sell Goodyear tires. So my father was very impressed. Well, my father said, I have a question for you. Why would a PhD want to study and be a student under a person who only went to one semester of college? Why a multimillionaire wants to be the student of someone who hasn't had a bank account since 1969 or signed a check and has nothing in his name? And most of all, why does a person whose family has been devotees of Krishna and Hindus for generation after generation after generation want to be the student of a Jewish boy from Chicago? Srinathji, Dr. Desai, he said, I can't answer your question. He said, I can tell you so many things that you will not understand. You have to come to India to understand. So my father wouldn't travel without my mother. So he called my mother right on the spot. I said, Dr. Desai is inviting us to go to India. Would you like to come to India? And my mother, do you want to know what her only question was? Her only condition? She asked my father to ask Srinathji, do they have toilets there? Now there's a background to this question. Do you want to hear the background? Yeah. Or I could go on and just leave it. Anyways, the community I was living in the early 70s, after I came back, was in the Appalachian Mountains, and I was living all alone on this mountain, and I was a Pujari, and I was taking care of cows. And in the winter, it was freezing cold. There was no heat, there was snow. And it was really, really muddy everywhere, this thick of mud. When you take a step, your foot would go off. Why anybody would live there? My Gurudev, you know, I was wanting to serve him, so I was pujari, doing artis and doing the dressing. Taking care of cows for many years, and my father came up. The only way to go up there, you had to go by an ox cart, 3 miles up a muddy path. He flew from Chicago to his airport. He rented a car. He got to his community. He took an ox cart up the hill. He came up. I was the only one there. It was a gloomy, cold day. There were no chairs. We had to sit on the cold floor. And he said, I need to use the bathroom. So I gave him a shovel. And I gave him a can with some water. And I said, you have to climb down the mountain and dig a hole and then wash yourself. And he looked at me. And he shook his head. And he said, I will hold it in until I get back to the airport. And he said, son, what do you do up here? And I brought him before the altar and showed him the deities, Radharani and Krishna. They were about this high and they were beautiful metal deities. And they were my life. I said, I serve them.
playing with dolls?
I said, Father, they're not dolls. They're deities. They're mortis. And I said, it's Krishna. This is his eternal consort, Radha.
Anyways, he must have told my mother about that because she asked that question. Do they have toilets in India? And Dr. Desai said, we have super excellent toilets in India. So they came. And when they met these people, when they met all of you, although they loved me, they respected me, they couldn't understand till they came to India. On the first day when they met you people and saw your culture and felt your hospitality, they were totally transformed. Every day we're coming, we were going to different places, to different homes, to take lunch prasad, dinner prasad. It was quite amazing. Every evening I would give lectures, they would come, kirtan. I would bring them back to their apartment. They were staying at a devotee's apartment. They would be weeping and weeping and weeping in joy. They would, how proud they were of me, they said. They had totally transformed, not because of me, because of the people of India. They had never, my mother and father are very popular people in America. If you talk to my father, he'll show you on his cell phone all these photos that used to be in his office. Dozens and dozens and dozens with some of the most famous entertainers and athletes and politicians in America. They knew everyone. They said, we have never had such friends, met such fine people as those in Mumbai. So one day, they were so having such the experience of their entire lives, the best experience. So we decided to take them sightseeing. So we went to the Elephanta Island. How many have been there? Please raise your hand. So we went to the ferry. At that time, my mother and father, I think they were in their 70s. This is 1989. And we go across on the ferry through that little area of the Arabian Sea. And in those days, I haven't been there since, but we were walking bizarre. And as we were walking, a male brown monkey jumped right in front of my mother. He was big, he was strong, and he was mean. He looked at my mother with these green eyes that looked so violently angry. Then he screeched and showed my mother his teeth. And I remember looking at those teeth, those big fangs coming down. They were shining in the sun. My mother, she froze. The monkey grabbed her purse. And my father screamed. He said, everything valuable we have is in that purse. Both of their passports, both of their airline tickets, all their credit cards, all their cash, and my mother's jewelry were all in that purse.
was pulling the purse. And my mother was desperately pulling it back. There was a tug of war. He pulled, she pulled, he pulled, she pulled, he pulled, she pulled. And she wasn't going to let go. Now, for those of you who have ever studied monkeys, they are expert at the art and science of intimidation. When I lived in the Himalayas, I used to study the monkeys. And by showing their teeth, by screaming, by jumping at each other, they try to psychologically create so much fear in somebody that usually the opposing monkey runs away at a certain point. Sometimes they actually fight. So this monkey screeched at my mother. And then, with his teeth showing very terribly, he jumped right into my mother's face. And then with his hind legs, he kicked my mother right in the chest. And this was serious culture shock for a lady from the suburbs of Chicago. She let go of the purse, the monkey ran away, and climbed up a tree, a big people tree. It was in a high branch, opening the purse. My father looked at me and said, "What are you going to do? Everything is in that purse." And my mother looked at me in total shock and said, "You are the one that brought us here. Do something." Now, if you remember, in 1989, the bureaucracy of India was quite complicated. It still kind of is. But in those days, for them to get new passports and new visas and new airline tickets and get their cancel their credit cards and everything else would have taken days and days and days constantly. It would have ruined their whole experience here. But the monkey was way, way up on this tree. So, what could I do? I just closed my eyes and prayed that Krishna, help me, help me. And nothing came. And then I opened my eyes and something came. I saw about a half a block away, there was a little fruit vendor. He had one of those push carts with wheels. So I ran up and asked him for one banana. He wanted me to give him 20 rupees for one banana. Because of the color of my skin, the prices go up. I went like this. I said, "Swami, I sadhu. Sadhu." I said, "Bakshish, bakshish, bakshish." And he said, "20 rupees, 20 rupees. He was very angry, man. 20 rupees. The problem is, I didn't have any money. My mother and father didn't have any money. The monkey had all the money. So this was a desperate situation. Do you remember the part where I passed urine on the feet of the bus driver? It was one of those situations. Of course, sometimes in an emergency, you have to do unconventional solutions. So I stole a banana from him. And he was angry as fire. He was going to beat me. I said, "I'm sadhu." So I ran away with the banana. And he ran after me. But destiny, as he was running after me,
committee, a different monkey attacked his fruit cart. So one monkey got me in trouble, another monkey saved me. He had to run back to fight off the monkeys because they were stealing all his bananas. He had to let one thief go free to catch another. So I ran up to that tree. And I showed the monkey my banana. And he looked at it. Do you know what the monkey was doing when I came down? With the purse open, he was passionately chewing on my mother's American Express credit card. I threw the banana. Go so close to him, so he had to jump to catch it. And as he jumped, the purse fell to the ground. And everything came out of it, and I put it all back in the purse, and I handed it back to my mother. She was so proud of me. Honestly, he said, you are the genius. My mother said, that was brilliant. You outsmarted a monkey. Anyways, they were so happy. And now I'm going to tell you the moral to the story. The mind is compared to a monkey. It always wants to go to places and do things that are going to get us in trouble. Temptations, aversions. Have any of you ever had that experience? The mind is chanchala. It's always going from one place to accepting, rejecting, angering, lamenting. Arjuna tells Krishna in the Gita, you are asking me to control my mind, but it's more difficult to control the mind than the raging wind. But the Gita tells, Vishaya Vinivartam Te Niraharasya Deyena Rasa Bharajam Nasopyasya Parudrispa Nivartate. That it's possible to control the mind and senses by giving something that is a higher experience, a higher fulfillment. And that is bhakti. This is that great secret of all secrets that the Bhagavad Gita talks about in the Gita. I learned it in Vrindavan. And I learned how to find it within myself from my beloved Gurudev, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. That higher taste, the taste of seva, the taste of loving God, loving Krishna, which is expressed through our service. And to the degree our service is unconditional, and unmotivated by any selfishness or greed for the pleasure of the Lord, it brings such a deep fulfillment to the heart that the mind, like the monkey, bhakti is like the banana that can actually control the monkey of the mind by giving it that higher taste. A About a year later, I returned and visited my family in the Chicago area. And all my relatives and all friends and everybody of my parents, they were telling me that that trip to India completely changed your parents' life. And they were all showing me how they were giving my all relatives and friends of theirs, they were giving cassette tapes of my lectures. And they were all telling me the story about the monkey and the banana. The next year, my brother was getting married. The family asked me to give the sermon for their marriage. My brother's Jewish, his wife Catholic, and they had a Krishna Bhakta Swami give the sermon for their marriage. It was my mother and father's idea. A couple years later, they had a baby, and they were wondering, do you like this story? Should I continue? Should we get the child baptized in the Catholic Church? Or should we get the child blessed in a Jewish synagogue? They weren't fighting over it, they were just trying to decide. And my mother, she said, do you want my opinion? They said, yes. And she said, you should have your brother baptize him in a Hare Krishna temple. So they agreed. So all the relatives, they live in Tucson, Arizona, my brother, so there's a temple there. So I came there, and I didn't even know how to baptize a baby in a Hare Krishna temple. But I put some things together. And my Gurudev Srila Prabhupada said, if there's ever a ceremony where you don't know exactly what to do, just chant the holy names and everything becomes auspicious. So I gave a little lecture to them about when we had kirtan, and I said to them, in this tradition, the blessings that you all want to be on this baby girl are going to come upon her to the degree all the relatives and friends cry out for God's blessings upon her by chanting these names. And I taught them the Hare Krishna mantra. And my mother, she had come from India, she said, I know how to do it, I'll show you. And she raised her arms like this and said, everyone raise your arms like this, and everyone cry from your heart to bless this baby. And I was chanting, and they were, Hare Krishna. Most of them were crying. Now this was a culture shock for me. My aunt Millie, my uncle Purr, my brother Marty, who used to ride a motorcycle and was like a really kind of wild, crazy person. They're all and my mother and father are leading them, and I'm singing. And, you know, in the church, they sprinkle the child with water for baptism. So I had one of those little sprinklers we use in the temple, and it was filled with water from the Ganga and Yamuna. And I sprinkled it on the little baby girl. And everybody considered, yes, this is a authorized baptism. And then I said, I think you need it more than her, and I sprinkled it on all of them. So they were a little confused about that. And then my mother, she said, give her a Krishna name. Her name was Sarah. So then I said to my brother, I said, do you want me to give her a Christian name? And he said, yes, your mother and father want you to give, you should give. So I said, her name will be Saraswati. This little white-colored American baby. And it had such an effect on her that my brother told me, if she was just like a couple months old or 6 months old or something when we had that ceremony. When she grew older, a little older, she was very naughty. But whenever she would be good to give something to someone, you know, like she'd pick a flower and give it to someone, she would always, just a little girl, just 3 years old, she'd say, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And my brother said, what did you do to my daughter? Whenever she's bad, she just says all kinds of other words, but whenever she does something good, she says, Hare Krishna. And then a couple of years later, a son was born. So of course, you know, they came and we did our purifying, our samskara. And his name was Bill, so we gave him the name Balaram.
Frank Sinatra. Have any of you ever heard of him? He's
one of the most famous American singers of my father's generation. He said, Frank Sinatra agreed to give me his private jet so the two of us could go to India to find your son and my daughter. And my father described, he said, there's 650 million people and he's in a cave. How are we going to find him? So it was such a beautiful thing. And you read in the book how when my mother passed away, I was in Mumbai. And I went back. And when I went back, the whole family together, my two brothers, my father, the aunts, the uncles, they all said unanimously that she should be cremated and her ashes should be brought to India. Now please understand, in the history of my family, no one has ever been cremated. In the Jewish tradition, burial is for every. We have families, you know, the tombstones of all family members close to each other. But they told me because she loved what Radhanath Swami is doing in India so much, and she loved the people of India so much. I'll tell you one little story. During the end of her life, my mother got Alzheimer's, where she really couldn't remember things. And toward the end, she hardly said a word. And one time, I went with my father to visit her. And we were sitting together. And my father was trying to get her to speak. For about 40 minutes, he was reminding her of things of their early life and things that she loved to do and people that she loved and trying to, do you remember this? And asking her this question and that question. And she just sat and smiled. She always was smiling when she had that disease. Just always smiling, quiet. And my father was trying to get her to say something. And I'm sitting here like this, and they said, he said, aren't you happy to see your son, the Swami, the Hare Krishna Swami? And she smiled really big, and she said, Hare Krishna. And for months after that, he couldn't get her to say anything, but every time he'd say Hare Krishna, she would say, Hare Krishna, and smile. We have here tonight Hrishikesh Mahatma. My mother and father, they loved this family so much. And his wife, Rekha Radhapriya. When they first came, they stayed at their house with them. My mother and father, they had never seen anything like this. People of such prestige, of such wealth, with completely unassuming devotion, was just serving them in the most simple, menial ways. They never had the servants do things for them. They did everything themselves with their children. My parents were weeping and crying. And when my mother, when her Alzheimer's were really difficult, even relatives weren't coming to see her. But the Mahatma family, Priyavrat, Hrishikesh, Rekha, they came and they sat for hours. And Rekha Radhapriya was holding my mother's hand. And I was traveling somewhere in the world, and somehow they connected with me. And my father was weeping like a child. said the love of these, the love of your people from India is unlike anywhere else. They are more our family than any of our family. The amount of sympathy, empathy, and love they have for your mother. Change their lives. So it was my mother's will and my whole family's will that she be cremated. And during the funeral ceremony, they asked me to give the eulogy. There were many, many people, all relatives and friends. Such a transformation. And I remember I was taking the ashes to him, and I didn't want to put them in luggage, because sometimes luggage is lost. So I was carrying them in hand baggage, and I had to change flights in London. And it was in this black box, ashes. And I put it through the metal detector, that machine, and the alarm went off. Asked me, you know, open up your very official, these men, security guards, he said, open up your bag. I open my bag. I see this black case. It looked really suspicious. I'm dressed like this. I look suspicious to them at least. And he said, what is that? And I said a little prayer. Krishna, please get me through this one for my mother. It shouldn't be like this, the honor of my mother. I said, I think I had tears in my eyes. I said, these are the ashes of my beloved mother that I'm taking to put in a river in India, according to her last wish. The security guard started to cry. He said, I'm so sorry. My condolences to you. Please pass. So when we were in Mayapur, the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya, there was about over 2,000 devotees on the bank of the Ganges. They had met, my mother had been there twice. Many knew her. They were all chanting beautiful prayers for Krishna to bless her immortal soul. And I went into the Ganga and I offered a little prayer. I write about it in the book. I'll tell you something interesting. I never just sat down to write this book, The Journey Home, because I'm always traveling and I'm always meeting people. So I had to write it in the middle of all these things. Every now and then I would take a week or two off to do the exclusive, but then I'd have to travel. So I was high on a mountain in Italy, not far from Florence, a place called Viareggio. And there's a beautiful forest up there. And I gave a lecture to all these Italian people in that forest. And I was staying in a 500-year-old house. On the grounds, they have 2,000 olive trees and all kinds of grapevines. And I spoke at night, and it was about midnight, and I went to my room, which was on a, you know, it's a a ground floor and a first floor. I had a little room there, and I was looking out at the moonlight and the stars, this ancient home in Italy, and I was writing. And I came to the part of the very end of the book, and I prayed, how should I end? And as I prayed like that, the image of my mother came to my heart. And I started started writing about when I put her ashes in the Ganges. And it's interesting. This is a secret. You may be the first people I've told, I don't know. But as I was writing this, I was typing it on a book computer. I'm going to divert. Last year I spoke at Cambridge University. And the topic they gave me was, it was at the Cambridge Union. The topic was how simple life was when apples and blackberries were only fruit. And they told me to speak on that subject from the journey home. So I told everybody at the beginning, I said, I have to tell you that I wrote the whole journey home on an Apple computer. So anyways, there I was in this ancient chalet or whatever, of Italian house made of big wood beams of trees, and I'm typing. And as I was typing this story of putting my mother's ashes in Ganga, tears were pouring from my eyes as I was writing it. Many places in that book I was weeping as I was writing, just the remembrances of certain incidents. And my prayer was, Mother Ganga, you are my spiritual mother. And now the body of my physical mother will merge with you. Please bring the beloved soul of my mother to the sea of Radha Krishna's supreme grace. Supreme grace. And I was thinking how this was so perfect, because bhakti means harmonizing our material bodies and all the things of this material world with the spiritual essence of life by using everything in the loving service of Krishna. I felt my beloved spiritual father, Srila Prabhupada, at that moment. It was his inspiration that actually gave me the wisdom and the blessings to try in whatever small way I could to actually utilize the beautiful resources God has given us in this world in the loving service of the Lord. So symbolic of putting my mother's ashes in my spiritual mother's, Ganga's, divine current. When I wrote The Journey Home, I really didn't know if anybody would read it. And I was thinking, if I tell the truth of what happened, I don't know if anyone will believe it. I tried to write it in a spirit of service. Because nothing is mine. Whatever little I've been entrusted with, my Gurudev taught that we should share it with whoever we can. And I cannot tell you how infinitely grateful I am to each and every one of you accepting this humble offering and giving such purpose and such blessing to my life by doing so.